next week. The week after that, live will be Ellen Datlow. This coming Tuesday, please, we want to see you at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, free admission, 388 Atlantic Avenue. Go to the Facebook page or go to my website for more information. Okay. Gee, that sounds like Hour of the Wolf is starting. And indeed it is. So, I'm going to make sure everything else is turned off. I'm really confusing myself. Three computers, two players. There we go. This, one of my readers on Tuesday will be Michael Swanwick. The other will be Rajan Khanna. But this now is an old Hour of the Wolf from, 2008, with the aforementioned Michael Swanwick. We'll be announcing phone calls and taking them and all that, but it's a recording, so never mind. Following that will be Project Censored, coming your way at 5 a.m. Thank you for listening. If you want to write me, it's jim@ourwolf.com. Have a great morning. Take care. And be good to each other. I'm going to listen to me intro, and then I'm out of here. It's nice to do an intro twice in a show, isn't it?
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Hour of the Wolf.
This is Hour of the Wolf.
A Saturday morning
Wednesday night
to science fiction.
Dedicated to science fiction.
Fantasy.
Fantasy.
Enchantment.
Enchantment.
Yes.
And yes.
The imagination.
My name is Jim Freund.
A show long, long awaited by me, at least. And I'm sure
it's in the past.
Yes. Live in the studio. Michael Swanwick.
Indeed. Well, Michael's actually been back since then, and he will be here live next Tuesday. Write me, jim@ourwolf.com. We'll tell you all about it. Hope to see you then. So keep on listening to my show, and have a good morning for the last show. Or both. Good night. That's my weakness now.
Love, 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 look what you've done to me. The things I never miss, all things I can't resist. Oh, love, 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 isn't it plain to see? I just had a change of heart. What can it be? He's the I think he knows just what it's raining for. He likes a long good night, and I never had a long good night, but he likes a long good night. So that's my weakness now. And he likes put the stutter, and I never can follow put the stutter, but he likes the put the stutter. So that's my weakness now. And he likes button the tada tada, and I never can follow button the tada tada, but he likes put the stutter. So that's my weakness now. What more? What more? Oh, I think he knows what Batata is for. He likes Pututaro. I never cared for a Pututaro, but he likes a Pututaro. So that's my weakness now.
And let that be a lesson to you about Bootleg Hooch. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Get a couple of quick announcements out of the way. Last week's New York Review of Science Fiction reading with Michael Swanwick and Judith Berman went exceedingly well. And unfortunately, you will not this year likely hear Michael's reading, because it would be one long bleep. Not the little bleeps we had for Lucius Shepherd a couple of weeks ago, but just one long, you know, tone. Not Michael's fault, but the fault of our current official reaction to the Federal Communications Commission. You will, however, hear the Judith Berman part of that. So to make up for that, Michael will be here, is here this morning, and more on that in a moment. If you enjoy the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, and you wouldn't dare go to the evil, terrible, horrible competition, which is this Wednesday at 7 p.m. Get there early because they fill up at the KGB bar, as run by Ellen Datlow and Gavin Grant. You wouldn't do that to go see Daniel Brown and Jeff Klima will be there, because this is all surrounding Electric Velocipede, a wonderful small press magazine, and Marley Humans. You wouldn't want to do that, would you? Admission is free. This is at 84 East 4th Street, and it's simply a wonderful event. So you know, if you're loyal to the event that I produced, don't go there. But if you do, say hi, because I'll be recording it, and I don't miss it. And I say don't go there because it gets very crowded, because it's a really great event. So there, 85 East 4th Street. For more information on that, go to lcrw.net. That's Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. Got that memorized? Good. .net. And, or just go to your favorite search engine. But it's a wonderful event, and these are not big name readers; these are merely great readers. So, you should go and enjoy. Next month at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, Wasteland, a anthology edited by John Joseph Adams, and our readers from that anthology will be John Langan and Carol M. Schwiller. So these are fine, fine people, and more on that as we get closer to the date. Through the years, one of my favorite writers has always been Michael Swanwick. And I run into Michael at many conventions, when I used to attend many conventions. I don't now. I hit about two or three at most a year, and Michael is at those. But in all this time, he is one of those few people that has somehow eluded me. We've done recorded interviews. I remember one at the Nebula Awards where we were recording something in a lobby, only to have people such as, I think it was a Haldeman, or it was long ago, it may have been a Haldeman or two, it was long ago enough, and certainly a Dozois coming by and
busting chops is the technical term.
Heckling was the word that I had in mind, but busting chops is the appropriate thing. We have broadcast but failed to find the recordings of readings that Michael has done in the past, because my archiving system has, in the past, has been so terrible. It's much improved now, I'm pleased to say, thanks to digital technologies. But you know, the infuriating thing would be finding a book to get autographed, such as at Last Reader Con or Capclave, I think it was, where I handed Michael a book for autographing, and I look at the inside afterward eagerly, and it says, "Jim, why don't you ever have me on your show?" This has been a running running gag for many years. And so this is an historic event to have you here live, and I couldn't be more pleased.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Good. Tell the audience a little bit about you. I should have it memorized, and I probably do. To begin with, I should keep notes with me, right? But the last 6 years, you have won... Five Hugos in 6 years. That has got to be a record.
Yeah, it's like the in Bull Durham, where there's the pitcher who's staying in. There's some little statistic there that nobody else cares about, but that he wants, so he'll have got some record, and that's mine. Five Hugos in 6 years.
Yeah,
Connie Willis has gotten more Hugos than I have. Other people have gotten more total recommendations, but that's my little statistic, so I'm happy with it.
Okay, and when you add up the other awards, such as the World Fantasy Award and the Nebulas and all that, have you ever, like, totaled your nominee? I don't think I've ever seen anybody in my lifetime as nominated as you are.
I think Robert Silverberg is more nominated.
Really?
Yeah. My editor, David Hartwell, when he was trying to pitch the book to the salesman to get them enthusiastic about it, came up with, I'm the third or fourth most nominated science fiction writer, fantasy writer ever, which means that I've lost more awards than almost anybody in the world. So
that's
you've
right.
got
I'll,
one
I'll
of
just look on that side
you have of one it. Of the bull goose losers here in the studio with you.
Okay, that's I'm going to try to stay off the bad puns.
Okay,
yeah, but it involves a gander. But at any rate, the. Michael writes huge amounts of short and short fiction and lots of novels as well. And I first became familiar with a book that – was it a Terry Carr selection?
Yeah, it was an Ace Special. And that was a wonderful lineup. There was Lucius Shepard in that, had his first novel. Howard Waldrop had his first solo novel, and a guy named William Gibson had something called Neuromancer, which I understand has done okay since then, all on that same line.
So, yeah, it was an amazing series of the Ace Special series that you didn't know the names because these were mostly first-time writers, and it didn't matter because you knew that you could depend on Terry Carr.
The people, we knew the names. The people that he chose were, there was a new generation coming into science fiction, and he just got them all because he cared.
What wave was that? This was after the new wave, which ended, I guess, in about 74.
There was never a generational name for the group. It devolved into the cyberpunk humanist wars.
Right.
And but quite frankly, the distinction between the cyberpunks and the humanists was purely political. Artistically, they were all on the same page.
Yeah, very much so. To the point where you would probably not have been termed a cyberpunk. You would have been termed a humanist. So
they certainly called me bad names, yes.
Yeah, they did. Well, you had a story in Mirror Shades, didn't you?
No, I did not.
You didn't. Oh, you're the one.
So I am officially not a
okay,
cyberpunk.
Okay, so you see you are a humanist after all.
But
you've collaborated, as it were, even in writing fiction with Gibson.
That's right. I co-wrote a story with him called Dogfight. It earned easily as much as any of my first three novels did over the years cumulatively.
Wow.
You know, $100 here, $50 there.
Right.
It adds up after a while. And I was actually the person who coined the term humanist. I wrote an essay about that generation because no, except for William Gibson, nobody was getting any attention or publicity.
Right.
And these were all writers I was excited about. And I essentially defined them as the cyberpunks were the people who were all to one side of me literarily, and the humanists were people who were the other side of me literarily, and right in the very center, the acme and golden mean of perfection was, of course, myself.
Right.
But I did not say a word about my own fiction in that.
Uh-huh. But you know, now, and now that you – I recall the essay, but I did not realize that that was the one which had coined the term and thereby helped define the divide. Which continues being defined because Kessel and Kelly, John Kessel and James Patrick Kelly, have just come out with yet another humanist?
No, they came out with a post-cyberpunk anthology.
Okay, but I know post-cyberpunk, but I thought they had something else in the works.
They always do.
Yeah. Was the car book, was that sort of your debut?
I had been, that was about 3, 4, 5 years into my career. My first two published stories were both on the Nebula ballot, and they both lost, which was a bit of good luck, actually, mm-hmm. because I've known people who won right off the bat, and then every year that they didn't win a major award felt like a failure. And it took me over a decade to win anything, so that by the time I won something, I felt, yes, I deserve it, simply for being so old. So I always so I enjoy the awards process. I don't take it that seriously, and I have some, which is what you require to not take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
My first novel was called In the Drift. It was not my title. It was the editor's title, and it was not very good. I wanted to write. I tell new writers what happened was, I wanted to write a novel. That's what I wanted to do, and with enormous effort, I managed to do this. Meanwhile, Bill Gibson wanted to rewrite the diction of and vocabulary of science fiction, and I succeeded, and he failed. But he failed at so much higher level than I did. And ever since then, I always tell new writers who tend to be modest and very overawed by people who actually publish this, say, aim as high as you can because you will never hit any higher than that.
Mm-hmm. So after this comes Vacuum Flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great book.
It was my space opera. It's a genre which is kind of forgotten now called the Grand Tour, mm-hmm. where you try to cover as much of the solar system as possible. Rebel Mudlark. What was her name? Rebel Elizabeth Mudlark? I forget.
That sounds right.
And she came into the solar system on a comet. And if you're paying close attention, which would take a textual analysis to do, she travels through the solar system from planet to planet on what is essentially a cometary arc. And at the very end of it, she leaves the system. And the thing about a comet is that when it's inside the inner system, it's very hard to tell whether it has a parabolic or a hyperbolic orbit. And the one is a closed orbit, which means that it will return. The other is an open orbit, which means it will leave the system and never come back. And I knew when I was writing it that it would end with her in the star docks with her husband's coffin at her feet. But I didn't know if he was in it or not, and I didn't know if she was going to return or not. And it wasn't until 2 pages from the end that I made that decision, and off she went.
During this time, you were writing across the spectrum. You're writing fantasy. You're writing science fiction.
I still am.
Short stories, long form, short shorts. You're never standing still literarily within the genre. You're always finding new places to go and things to uncover, including the extended mosaic short, like the elements table. And
I'm not in this for the money. If I were in this for the money, I would take one world and just return to it over and over and over again, mm-hmm. which is the formula for success. I'm in it for the art. I'm in it for the possibilities. And, you know, science fiction, fantasy, it's, you know, there, we think of them as genres, but really they're not. What they are is they're a set of tools.
Mm.
And these tools allow you to do something, to do things that you cannot do without them. And I like to say, when God gives you a set of burglar tools, he does not expect you to sit around in the library of your house tinkering with the hi-fi set. You are supposed to go out and ransack the secrets of the human heart.
That's wonderful.
Well, that's my job.
Okay, ransacking the secrets of the human heart. Okay. Sounds like something we'll read up on Flogging Babel, no doubt.
Maybe. I found Flogging Babel is my website. It's called that because I'm ruthlessly flogging my new book, Dragons of Babel. My editor told me to create a blog to do so, so I obeyed. And it's had an unexpected advantage to me. Because as a working writer, essentially what I do is I sit in front of a computer screen and I move my fingers all day. And my wife comes home at night and she says, what was your day like? And I hold up my hands and I move my fingers. And I said, it was like that. So really my impression was that I never get out and I never do anything. And then I committed to making 3 posts a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, on my blog, and I discovered that actually without my paying any attention to it, I do rather a lot of different things. There's always more things to write about than I actually have time, space on the blog to fill.
Mm-hmm.
So it's improved my self-image. Apparently I actually do have a life.
This is good, yeah, and so many of us don't. I have 2 blogs now, and I put 1 entry into each in late November, and I haven't gotten around to a second entry yet, but one of them will be about having a life, and I haven't enough of one to be able to find the time to put it in there.
So I was in China recently, in Chengdu, for a science fiction conference there with, among other people, Nancy Kress and Neil Gaiman. And Neil has got one of the more successful blogs for any writer. He appears to post in there pretty much every day. And and knowing how much work it is just to sit down and blog, it's the same kind of work to keep a diary, I realize that the reason he can do this is that he's on the road a lot. And when you're on the road and he does a couple of months of serious promotion a year for his whatever studio he's got a movie coming out in. And when you're on the road a lot, the first thing you do, you come into a hotel room, is you turn on the television. And that provides you with a background that's something comfortable and familiar, your electronic equivalent of home.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that for him, that sitting down, flipping open his laptop, and doing the blog provides that same continuity while the hotels appear and disappear around you.
Well, like ever-changing, I'm thinking of the sequence in the movie The Time Machine where the mannequin is constantly changing.
Exactly right. There. So really with a blog, it all depends on whether there's a need for it or not, whether you have the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, skipping a little forward to the present and slightly back, because we're talking about the Dragons of Babel. And you were saying that what you have not done is found one universe and return to it over and over again, which causes commercial success usually. Yet this is actually a sequel, which is unusual for you.
It's sort of a sequel. When I began the story, essentially, I was hit up for an anthology to write a dragon story. And I said, I don't think I've got any stories in me, but I'll give you one if I think of one. And the way these things turn out, I came home and immediately a wonderful image came to me of a young boy in Faerie when the dragons pass overhead. And the dragons are great war machines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the dragons came from my earlier book, The Dragons of Babel. The Iron Dragon's Daughter, which was about a young girl who had been captured by the elves and forced to work in a factory building dragons. So I had identical dragons.
And interestingly, by the way, you have a huge fandom based on that book alone, which you're not necessarily familiar with all your other works.
It's my cult book, and it certainly it connects best with the readers of anything I've written so far, partly because of the hero, Jane Alderbury. And Jane was a gift from God. She was so brave. She had such good character, and she's in a world that there is no place for her and can be no place for her. And every time that she got slammed down by horrific events, she picked herself up and she plugged herself in and she tried again. She tried something new. She was a far better person than I am, and I think that's a lot of it. But I had the identical dragons, and then I had a story which, in the thinking about it, grew very quickly into a satisfying novel. And I began to write it. There were, except for the dragons, there were and the aesthetic, there were no connections between the two novels. There are no common places. There are no common characters. There are no common gods, even. And as I was writing it, I was aware of the fact that it could be in the same world as the Iron Dragon's Daughter, or it might not be. And I did not know which way to do it. About three-quarters of the way through, I decided that there was no reason for it not to be in the same world, and that some people would derive pleasure from it being in the same world. So I said, all right, it's the same world. So I brought back one of the characters from the first novel, and she makes a cameo appearance in this novel, meets Will at a party, he's baffled by her, goes away, and those who have read the Iron Dragon's Daughter will get a little kick out of that scene, and those who haven't won't even notice that they've missed something.
So so we should probably flog Babel for a bit.
It's a brilliant book.
You've been telling me that for a long time. You usually are not quite so forthright about go out and get this for me, but for about when I asked you first to read at the Nursef readings and the Ubiquitous, when are you going to do a radio show, you came out with, I've got this wonderful book that I'm going to have to promote. And this is unusual for you to say how good a particular work of yours is, and then to actually go and almost set up a tour for yourself, which you have done here. So that's
a one-stop tour.
Indeed, but a whistle stop, at least a major whistle. If I didn't have these bad teeth, I could do it. Two stops, because you did the reading, and now you're here. So it's two stops in 1 week. It's unusual for you to be specifically pushing a particular title of yours, isn't it?
It is. I've been far too modest in the past. I should have listened to the advice my old friend Jack Dan gave me decades ago when I was a new writer and I'd sold a couple of things, but I hadn't published anything yet. They're all in the works. He came by to visit and he said, so what are you working on, Michael? And I said, well, I'm working on this story, but, you know, it's got this, it's not all that good. It's got this problem. It's got that problem. And Jack grabbed me by the lapels and he shook me and he said, Michael, never criticize yourself. That's what other people are for. And you know, he is right. I found that other people are willing to do that job for you.
Yes, yes, all too willingly, sadly.
And at some point I recognized that people will never estimate you any higher than your own estimation. And so now I get up on a panel at a convention. I introduce myself and I say, I'm Michael Slonick, and I am possibly the greatest science fiction fantasy writer alive. And
the fact that this may be true is irrelevant.
They take this, well, people will take that under advisement.
Uh-huh.
If you get up there and say, I'm okay, I'm not very good, they'll believe that.
Mm.
Well, why should the one be true and the other not? Of course it's not. But you have to be more open about the possibilities. This is actually is a good book. It's got something that most of my books do not have. It has a happy ending.
Yeah, I have not read it yet. I have to admit, I received it early last week, and now I'm annoyed. I just remember what I forgot to bring this morning. I didn't have you autograph it on Tuesday because I knew I'd see you here Wednesday. Now I left it at home. Darn it! But
well,
I'll catch up some other time on that autograph.
It has a happy ending. As I was writing this, my wife Marianne was reading it chapter by chapter when I thought it was good enough for her eyes. And one chapter from the end, Marianne said, this doesn't end well, does it? Said, oh, no, this is a happy ending. And she says, it doesn't end well for Alcyone. And I said, oh, it ends well for everybody. Everybody gets a happy ending. And at the end of the novel, she had to admit that I was right. You know, you can't see it one chapter before it happens, but this has a happy ending for everybody.
Good. Yes, and without pulling a W.S. Gilbert, I'm sure.
It's not easy to allow people a happy ending when I'm writing something because I feel constrained by the truth. You know,
what a terrible thing.
As a writer, you are given a special license to lie.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to tell enormous whoppers. You know, there are no elves or ogres or centaurs or mechanical dragons, or most of the things in this book are entirely made up. But the price for this is that you have to tell the truth about the way things really are. This is all in the service of telling the truth. And so you cannot give a happy ending where you would not have a happy ending in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And because to do so is to tell a terrible, terrible lie.
That's also very much in the tradition of the household tales and of the original so-called fairy tales as opposed to tales of fairy, they are pretty dismal. They are dark.
They're terrifying.
Yeah,
but they're
I grew up of German stock, so you know I grew up with stories like you know Struwwelpeter and the really Teal Eulenspiegel and the really you know forget dark. This is Tim Burton. It's light compared to the stuff I was growing up with.
When I wrote The Iron Dragon's Daughter, I pasted up a picture of the Sex Pistols on my monitor as a reminder to myself that all of these dark elves and wolf boys and such had to be at least as scary as these guys in the Sex Pistols.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tendency for fantasy to become warm and comfortable, and wouldn't it be nice to be having these adventures? Well, no. The rule of thumb is if it's an adventure, it's not nice at all. If it's pleasant and fun, it's a vacation. So,
yeah, I mean, all these characters, to use the big metaphor, they have to go into the woods.
They have to go into the woods, and it's dark in the woods, and there's scary things there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no point to pulling your punches in a novel because it's fiction. You know, Tolstoy did not throw Anna Karenina in front of a train. That would have been a very evil thing to do. But there was no Anna Karenina. There were just words on paper. And what we're trying to do is to stir the reader to genuine and appropriate emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, you have to allow bad things to happen.
Yeah. Do you do the same in your science fiction?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you see them as the same genre?
No. I discovered this when I wrote Stations of the Tide, which won the Nebula. It was a fantasy-flavored science fiction novel.
Mm-hmm.
I said in the course, I set myself a goal when I wrote it that there be a separate act of magic in each chapter and an escalating series, and that each act of magic be nothing that Isaac Asimov would not have conceded could actually happen in our universe. So no ESP, no psychic powers.
Mm-hmm.
They don't exist. I'm sorry. But in the first chapter, somebody does a magic trick, a sleight of hand, makes a parakeet disappear. And it works its way up through different acts of magic until you're getting into tantric sex magic. And then I wrote The Iron Dragon's Daughter, which is set, you know, in an industrialized fairy. So it's a very science fiction-flavored fantasy novel. And doing the one after the other showed me that the big distinction between the two of them is that science fiction is set in a knowable universe. You may not be intelligent enough to understand it, but it could be understood
mm-hmm.
perfectly by somebody with a large enough intellect. Fantasy, at the center of fantasy is mystery. And the center of the fantasy universe is a mystery that you can't know and you can't grapple with. I mean, you really are in God territory there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to write about God, then at some point you're going to have to say, I can't tell you everything you want to know. You're going to have to wait till after you're dead.
Yeah. And the best stories that take place in proper fairy usually take place on either the border. They tend not to be in fairy itself. They tend to be more about people who go in and come out and how they've been affected and, you know, boarding their milk white, somebody else's milk white steeds to go back and forth. But few of the stories that I can think of, at least the better ones, actually take place within fairy itself. And those scenes that do are simply looking down at the mortals.
It's a hard thing to create. But when you can do it, the rewards are great. I was talking about this with Marianne earlier. And one thing that fantasy does, especially in a novel like this, is it confronts you with the essential strangeness of the world. And we all have moments when we experience that. There's a moment when, for no reason, all of a sudden, just everything in the world dazzles and is filled with wonder, and you become aware of what a miracle it is to be alive. And the world life is like that all the time, and much larger dimensions than we can sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we have our lives to get on with. We have to get to work. We're not feeling well today. You can't live in that, you know, in that ecstatic medium all the time. But it's true nevertheless. And fantasy, you know, real fantasy, hard fantasy, fantasy that works, just confronts you with that. Just makes you look at the world anew and realize, you know, what a strange and marvelous thing it is to exist.
Mm-hmm. What then is the attraction to you for science fiction?
I started out wanting to be a fantasy writer. J.R.R. Tolkien came along when I was 16. I read Lord of the Rings. I read the Fellowship of the Ring. I picked it up at 11 o'clock at night after finishing my homework, and I thought I would read a chapter or two before going to bed, and I started to read. And the next morning at 8:02, I finished the last word of it just as the home bell rang at my high school. And I did not sleep a wink.
The
Fellowship of the Ring.
Right, okay. And so not and the whole trilogy, not the whole
first, the
novel
first book,
proper.
I did not sleep a wink. I had to skip breakfast. I had to read as I was walking to school. But I finished it that night, and it rang me like a bell. That was the event that turned me into a writer, ultimately. Mm. But at that time, although I was young, I was trying to write Tolkien-esque fantasy. It was far beyond me, and at that point, it was far beyond anybody. In the course of the next 2 or 3 years, I read literally every piece of fantasy that had ever been written, and was actually
a tall order.
But there wasn't a lot of it then. There was not very much of it at all, and so I started reading science fiction because it gave me a fantasy-like kick. And then, because science fiction is more difficult than other forms of fiction, you have to write a good story, and then you have to have the science fiction idea on top of that. You have to get the science right. It's just like adding another layer of complexity to the Enterprise. That won me over. It was more difficult, and therefore, if you're ambitious, you're going to go gravitate right to the most difficult task you can see. When I'm in science fiction mode, there is the pleasure of creating things which might actually come true. There's that engagement with the universe as it is. I guess the difference is that with science fiction, you're engaging with the things of the universe, and with fantasy, you're really engaging with the human soul. Two great magisteria, equally important.
Yeah, I would say so. Why don't we take a brief break, and then you can either read a short piece for us. I actually have Storyteller Rock with me, by the way, so we can go either way. But talking all about this, let's see, do you want something elfin, something Thomas the Rhymer, Raggle-Taggle-Gypsy-O?
Raggle-Taggle-Gypsy-O would do good. Okay. I wrote a story called that once.
Yeah, well, yes, that we broadcast here.
Ah.
In days when we were a little bit freer in terms of... What's called Safe Harbor. So give me a moment. Now, do you have a preferred version?
No.
I bet you I've got it. Because
okay.
I have... okay, hold on 1 second. Let's see. Whoa. Yeah, Gypsy Davy. There are so many different names for this. I have, Lord help me, 467 versions of this song with me. I am not exaggerating.
Pick one quickly.
Okay, let's see. Well, how about, Incredible String Band or Steel Eye Span?
Okay.
String Band?
String Band.
Yeah, okay. I also have Pentangle. Okay, here we are. And even on the String Band, I've got let's see, the Live BBC. Okay, here we are. So, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio. You're listening to Hour of the Wolf, and we'll be back shortly.
Time to come.
And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM and also heard over WBAI.org and archived at a similar place. But for more longer-term archives for this program, go to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, the radio station archive last 2 weeks, my archives last 8 months. So you might be listening to this 8 months from now, in which case it's about to expire. But so make a copy quick. Let's see. Yes, that was Steel I Span with Blackjack Davy, and before that, the Incredible String Band with Raggle Taggle Gypsy-O, all based on the same story. Child Ballad number 200. Ooh, yes, number 200 this morning on the Child Ballad Parade of Music here on Hour of the Wolf. Our guest, Michael Swanwick, one of the great writers of science fiction fantasy, and certainly one of my favorites, and master of the short short, a title that probably used to belong to, I guess, Frederick Brown.
Frederick Brown. You know, it was a very strange thing to discover that I could write short shorts. I did it by accident. I started writing them, and I discovered I simply have a knack. And I started writing them in I got into them because I could do it in the evenings when I wasn't working. I could colonize another part of time for my writing. And the thing about them is that it's an interesting and involving art form. It's not very profitable.
Mm.
And what I found is that the individual short short...
We should mention to listeners, writers get paid by the word.
We get paid by the word. And a good short short has got the same structure and is not much longer than a joke. So an individual story can only have so much artistic content. There's not a lot of space there for characterization. There's not a lot of room for depth. But I discovered I was doing things... Like I did abecedaries, one short for each letter of the alphabet, or I did a series based on Goya's series of etchings, Los Caprichos.
I remember those.
Called The Sleep of Reason, and they're dark and tangled stories. I found that when you do a series of short shorts, they acquire a depth and a complexity that you expect from art. So I'm going to read a story from the periodic table of science fiction.
And these were originally written for Datlow, were they not?
They're written Ellen for Datlow. Ellen Datlow for sci fiction. And
the lamented, late lamented, a website that was just garnering so many awards and publishing so much great fiction that, but was owned by a television station. So true to form, as happens so much in TV, as it starts getting really great and getting a lot of notice, they just canceled it. They just killed it.
And for a period of 118 weeks, I was writing one story a week and posting it online for Ellen. And then for an interlapping period, I was also writing the 80 stories in Goya's Los Caprichos and
right.
posting them on the Infinite Matrix, edited then by Eileen Gunn, one a week for 80 weeks. And so there was a period there of roughly 2 years when if I entered a room that contained writers, they would turn pale and hold up crucifixes and back away from me, because I was a figure of terror to writers.
Yeah, and we should point out not only quantity but quality.
I think these are good stories. I'm going to read the first one in the periodic table of science fiction. Number one, for hydrogen, atomic weight 1.00794. And it's called The Hindenburg. Time agents like to rendezvous at famous disasters. It goes with the personality. They don't trust you to remember the date otherwise. which was why I met Ivan at Lakers Naval Air Base at the day the Hindenburg was due to burst into flames. We were in the CO's office, and don't think that wasn't hard to arrange when he gave his report. Herr Eidenbenz wouldn't listen to reason, he said, so I left my briefcase under his couch and made an anonymous call to the Gestapo. He died under interrogation 3 days later. Ivan grinned incandescently. No atom bomb for Uncle Adolf. Good work, I said. I'm Jewish myself, and if it were up to me, Hitler would have been strangled at birth. But we'd tried that once and only made matters worse. Now we rely on men like Ivan, one in a billion talents, who are able to remember multiple pasts and so guide events toward the desired future. Have a drink. I poured us each some of the commander's bourbon. Through the window I could see the great Zeppelin, large and placid, moving with slow grace toward the mooring tower. It was a creepy moment for me, knowing how many people were about to die. We clicked glasses. Poor Eidenbenz, I said. Does it bother you, all the pain we inflict on innocents like him? Are you nuts? I make history turn cartwheels. It's like being a god. He gestured toward the Zeppelin. You people are no more distinct to me than so many hydrogen atoms. You rush about and bump furiously into each other, and what difference do any of you make to where the airship goes? Me? I can do anything I like, and who's to stop me? You can't even tell what I've done. You forget and think it was always so. He took out a pocket detonator and punched the button. Outside, there were sudden shouts of alarm. You even forgot I did this. The flames from the burning Hindenburg cast a satanic glow over his features. He smiled. Oh, he murmured, the humanity.
I think I've heard the Hindenburg disaster more than watched it, so those words, oh, the humanity, are always particularly haunting. Lovely, lovely little piece. Which was the hardest element?
Vanadium, vanadium. Oh, God, vanadium. When I started the project, Ellen had seen my abecedaries and wanted to know if I could do something like that. And I could not rouse the interest in doing another 26 stories, one for each letter, because I'd done it at least twice already.
You could do the Cyrillic version.
I knew I could do it. I needed something that was a challenge, and I came up with the idea of the periodic table. And the thing about that what made it interesting was there was always the possibility of failure. And it's like watching the trapeze artist. You do not want the trapeze artist to fall, and you do not want the tightrope walker to fall off. But the fact that they could actually fall is what makes it so exciting. There's that element of danger, and then they do not fall. So I went in knowing it was possible to fail abysmally. And then I came to vanadium, and I started to research it. And there was nothing interesting to be found there. You know, vanadium, it sounds like Canadian, but not enough. It's vans. No, there's nothing interesting about vans in vanadium. The most interesting thing I could find out researching the properties of it was that it is an essential element in the diet of chickens. So I had, before I started the project, I had come up with a get-out-of-free-jail card. And I pulled it out of my pocket. And I said, vanadium is the couch potato of the periodic table of the elements. It never shows up at your house at 1 o'clock in the morning dressed in fabulous drag with a tuxedo for you to wear and takes you out dancing in the clubs. It never hitchhikes to British Vancouver naked. It never dances the fandango on top of taxis along with Zelda Fitzgerald. And I went on this riff for a while and said, it disgusts me, you know. And I finished this. I said, well, I've ducked the bullet. And then who, boy, did I get letters. People were really angry at me. It turns out that Vanadium has got a lot of fans.
Oh, my.
And people were writing in letters saying...
Everything has a fandom somehow.
Saying, wow, yeah. It's a catalyst, for Pete's sake. How dull can a catalyst be? And I realized after the fact that what had happened was that a lot of chemistry teachers were using these stories to turn their kids on to chemistry.
Oh, dear.
And I had just stabbed them in the back. All of these, you know, chemistry teachers had a really a much-needed element of madness to our world.
Yes.
And all these guys with the bow ties and that crazy little glint, I had stabbed him in the back. I felt terrible about that.
So, this brings up the question: what is the toughest research you've ever had to do for your books, for your stories?
Well, for the novel I'm writing right now, I went earlier this year, and I went to Moscow for a couple of weeks. And it's a beautiful city. I love Moscow. I really like Russians. And it's a dangerous and a profound time for Russia.
Which is why so many of your stories have such downward, real human endings, I think. That Russian...
Well, it's, you know, there was a movie recently, Night Watch, and it's a Russian fantasy movie, and it's a war between good and evil.
But let me just mention to listeners, available on DVD and well worth watching.
Yeah, a wonderful movie. I saw the posters for it first when I was in Yekaterinburg in Russia 4 years before that. And
Daywatch just came out.
And Daywatch just came out. And the thing about it is, it's set in Moscow because it's a Russian movie. But, you know, when you set a battle between good and evil in Moscow, all of a sudden it's not a given who's going to win. History tells us that being on the side of good doesn't mean that you're going to be the winner.
Right.
I went to Moscow, and it's a wonderful place. I love it a lot. But if you're going to Moscow, you either need to have a lot of money or the ability to speak Russian or a friend on the ground. And we had a friend, Alexei Bezugli, and he just worked very, very hard to make it possible for us to rent a place there. We could not have found our flat. We could not have rented it. We could not have managed to visit Moscow without him. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, that was the most difficult.
Interesting.
When you're writing a novel, basically, you're always researching it. And as a result, you sort of live half in that world. And my experience has always been that as the novel progresses, it becomes a race to finish the research before the novel's done. So that you can at least say, yes, I did do the research. I had to stay up late the last night. I had to pull an all-nighter to finish it. But I did the research before actually writing the last word.
You are extremely well-traveled. This year alone, this past year, I should say, 2007, you were in, that I'm aware of, China, Russia, and Japan.
I was not in Japan.
You were not in Japan?
No, no.
You did not attend the World Cup?
I did not have the money to do so.
Oh, my. Because I'm aware of the Chinese trip. I've heard anecdotes about, aside from you, from our mutual friend Srina, about your travels. And I know that was just before the World Cup. I'm very surprised you did not actually...
I had spent all my travel money going to Japan, and the convention paid my way to China.
Uh-huh.
So that was a large expenditure for them to bring in to bring in foreign writers, and it would have been, I think, tantamount to an insult to not taken it.
Right.
But I just did not have the travel money to also go to Japan afterwards. And as I understand it, after 2 weeks in Chengdu, which was so wonderful as to be exhausting, to then follow that up with Japan,
mm-hmm.
I would have been running the risk of simply going into my hotel room after the convention and collapsing.
Yeah.
And thus not getting to see it.
Which I heard a lot of people did, basically. And I've always, I have not had the luxury of traveling a lot, but I have always been fearful of not having the time, hearing about these tours, of taking in any of the places I've gone to.
It would have been nice to have gone there. I lost another Hugo there this year, past year.
Yeah.
For Lord Weary's Empire, which is a section of the Dragons of Babel.
Mm-hmm.
It actually came in second, which was pretty good because
this was a novelette?
Novella. Okay. And that's pretty good because the Hugo, there's a bias for science fiction. I think a proper bias. So it's very hard for something that is a stone fantasy novella such as what I wrote to win. So I was really thrilled that it got that close.
Yeah. But again, we have to point out that Michael Swanwick is the kind of writer that when other people win awards, they often get up there and say, first of all, I'd like to thank Michael Swanwick for not writing in this category this year.
Well, that's Mike Resnick is famous for that, and Mike has a shtick which I admire greatly. When you're nominated for a Hugo, they give you a little rocket shaped pin which you can then wear in your lapel, and of course, almost nobody is actually tacky enough to wear it except when they first give it to you. You put it in your lapel,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of nice for you.
I would never take it off.
Yeah. Well,
myself.
What Mike does is he takes all of his pins and he puts them around his convention badge and then down on his buttons. And so it's like about 3 pounds of metal on there.
Looking like some decorated war hero.
Yeah, it's like a veterans of future wars. and he also has got, I actually looked this up at one point, he's got 5 Hugos too, and he's also almost as big a loser as I am, so he has nothing to complain about.
Okay.
We like to meet, we've been several times up for the same Hugo, and we have a little tradition when that happens. We get together beforehand and I say to him, because this will have no effect whatsoever on the outcome.
And I hate
to
voice over Michael Swanwick and myself.
He says, and
but
on
I
the
wanted
same
to
terms,
tell
Michael,
you, this
I
is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacific Radio
the Michael
at 99.5 FM.
Hugo.
Why am I out of breath?
I don't think I've ever actually
I left my keys here. I'm doing a station break.
Mm.
You're listening to rebroadcast.
You
from
are,
2008.
It's such an amazing thing to me, not only that you are so prolific, but that it's also good. I mean, that's the thing. There are a lot of prolific writers and a lot of good writers, but to have both at the same time where somebody can simply pick up something with your name on it and know that whatever the length, whatever it is, it's going to be entertaining and interesting and good is unusual. So it brings up
I am wonderful, aren't I?
Yeah. I need an appropriate card here or something. But it brings up the question of the discipline of writing. I know there are a lot of listeners who are always interested in the mechanics of writing. And, how do you write? Do you write absolutely every day? Do you have a set schedule? What are the mechanics of your discipline?
I have a 9-to-5 job 5 days a week. I get up in the morning and I have breakfast and I read the newspaper and I take my cup of coffee upstairs and I come down at the end of the day. And that's what I do. I don't write on weekends. Mm-hmm. I do carry a notebook with me always, so if I come up with good ideas or inspiration, and inspiration is way overrated, I have to say, because it doesn't come along very often. The important thing is to just sit down and write. When I had sold my first two stories, I had a writer's block. It lasted 9 months, and during which I lost my job, turned 30, and got married. So it was a very tense period of my life, and during that time, I went, and every day I sat at the typewriter or the computer, whichever I was using that day, mm-hmm. and I wrote for 8 hours and crumpled, and every word that I wrote crumpled up, threw into the wastebasket. And I did this over and over and over again until finally my hindbrain got the message that not giving me any usable ideas was not going to get it out of sitting here in the chair and writing. So it gave up, and I was able to write again. So, and ever since then, I've been aware of the fact that it's just amazingly hard work.
It is. It really is.
But that's all that it is. It's just hard work. And, you know, there are people out there who have jobs in construction or auto mechanics, and their work is every bit as difficult. Mm-hmm. So no reason for me to complain.
Right. Do you, you know, speaking of inspiration and all that, how far do you know what you're going to be writing? How many future trunk stories do you have, as it were? Actually, a good question is also, how many trunk stories do you have now? But also, how far in advance do you know what you're going to be writing next? Two utterly different questions.
Let's see. There's
both bad ones, so you can ignore
them. Okay, trunk stories. There's a very short mainstream story I wrote, which was a description of two of my very close friends behaving badly on their wedding day, which I've never tried to sell. And there was a crime story, which I wrote in 1978, which I wasn't able to sell. And that's it for Trunk.
Hmm.
I've been able to sell everything I've written.
Wow.
Now, if you go onto my hard drive, I'm working on something like 40 stories right now at the same time.
Wow.
I have a half dozen novels lined up in the queue, and I have to suspect that most of them never will get written because I can only work on one novel at a time.
Right.
But how do I know what I'm going to write? I sit down and I go onto the computer and I go into a file and I begin writing. When I'm working on a novel, usually that's what I work on. But some mornings I get up there, I just don't feel like that. And I'll look through the stories and go, that looks interesting. Maybe I can do something with that. And I'll start working on it. The oldest story that I have started with a good solid beginning and not completed. It's 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
A story called Robot, which I began when Bill Gibson and I were working on Dogfight. We had this method where each person hung on to the story for a month. During that month, you could do nothing or you could do everything. You could rip out every word the other person wrote if you wanted to. You could change the sexual orientation of the hero if you wanted to. Anything, anything, anything. And then the next person back would be able to take everything and take it out and put it back in if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a couple of small elements in there which I thought were pretty clever, and I wrote in, went to Bill, he took them out, went back to me, I put them back in, went to him, he took them out. It was like ping pong, and finally I let him have his way, and I saved them. But I said, these are good little bits, and I'll start another story, which I'll throw those in. And I did. I've got a really brilliant opening. If you read it, you'd want to read the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't quite figured out how it goes yet. It's like that guy who has got all the old cars in his backyard up on cinder blocks, and he's going to fix them all, and every now and then he adds a carburetor to one or a transmission to another, and once every 7 years, one of them actually rolls out of the backyard. That's what that's like. I think most of the short stories will get written. Only a few of the novels will, because novels require so much of one's time that you have to only give them to whatever happens to be the absolute best novel idea you have at the time.
Mm-hmm. Talking about collaboration, you haven't done a lot of collaborative work lately, have you?
Not lately. I did a lot basically as a way of learning. My gardener Dozois is an old friend of mine, and he is old school in that way. You know, that idea that collaboration is just another way of getting more stories. And he and Jack Dan used to do a fair number of collaborations. And as a new writer, I got kind of swept into this. Mm-hmm. And we'd sit around, have this all-night session, sit around, we'd plot out a story. And then I'd be given the first draft to do, basically, or the first large chunk, and it would go around. And new writers tend to have more energy. So that's a good reason for them to bring in a junior writer there. I was willing to do the hard lifting of putting inadequate prose down on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And then the revision is much easier than the actual creation. And it was as much work for me to do my share of these stories as it would have been to have written an original story, but it was a good education.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a great deal from them. I remember one time, I even forget what story this was, but I ran into Jack, and Jack said, "How's that story going?" And I said, "It's going really well. I made a change in it that will surprise you." And he stopped for a second, and he said, "I know what change you made, and you're going to find that it doesn't work." And he was right, of course. So something like that was priceless. The reason I co-wrote the story with William Gibson, I wouldn't do it today because his reputation is much larger than mine. I'll be riding on his coattails. At that time, we were both scruffy, ambitious young writers nobody ever heard of.
Hmm.
And he had told.
And there was a literary movement to support at the time.
Well, that was before there was even a literary movement. There was just ambition.
Mm.
And nobody ever heard of either of us. And he had told a friend that he had a work from images. He had this image of a couple of a batch of rednecks who were projective telepaths. Except that the only thing that they could project were little tiny World War I airplanes. And this image of them all leaning over a pool table of these dogfights going on over the green felt.
This is a wonderful story. I remember it well.
And I had a story in mind. I had a frame for a story. It was when I was new to Philadelphia. I knew almost nobody there. I'd just done something really clever. And I was walking back to my apartment feeling really good about it. And then I realized that there was nobody to tell this to. I couldn't explain to anybody. I didn't know anybody who could say what a clever thing I'd done. And all the joy of it went out of me. I was like deflated. And I said, there's a good framework for a story. And I had been like searching around for an idea. I was like in computer gaming, which was new then.
Mm-hmm.
And none of it was working. I heard this image, I saw it would fit into my framework perfectly. So I ran across Bill Gibson at a convention the first time I ever met him, and I said, my friend told me about this great image you had, and with an almost psychic ability to see right to what I want, he said, well, if you want to use the idea, you can. And he said, or if you want, you can collaborate with me. Well, there was no reason for me to collaborate with him because I already had a story. I could write it myself. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people were really enthusiastic about Bill's writing, unlike other new young writers nobody had ever heard of. People like Bruce Sterling and Pat Cadigan. And I said, let's collaborate, because I wanted to see what kind of chops he had. And I wanted to watch him working on his story. And it turns out that he's not only a successful writer, but he is actually a very good writer on a sentence-by-sentence level. So watching him, I was able to learn things from him as well. And that's what the whole purpose of collaboration for me has always been about. It's a self-education.
Mm-hmm. Can you envision a time where you would do it again? Obviously, you have your chops, but there are people now who might be wanting their own. Would you give of that?
I might well do it. Charles Strauss and I were going to collaborate on a story, and I thought this would be really great because we're both idea men.
Yeah.
And it would be really great to put us there trying to one-up each other. Only the problem was that we actually, started emailing back and forth about it, was he had just signed contracts for something like 8 novels, so he had to get a batch. He didn't have the time to play. He had to get a lot of stuff out of the way. And it was, it was either like take something one of us had written and then half of and have the other complete or put it off. And so I said, so I put it off until he's got time to have fun. He would be a good guy to do something nice and hard and crunchy with.
Mm-hmm. Nonfiction. You've done some wonderful nonfiction books, and often with wonderfully absurd premises. Being Gardner d'Oswald comes to mind, which is quite a feat to write a book, a full length book about somebody like Gardner and taking that premise. But you've also written, I have to crib and just look, this fascinating, the Postmodern Archipelago.
I just wrote a monograph called What Can Be Saved from the Wreckage, James Branch Cabell the 21st Century. And it's a look at the totality of Cabell's oeuvre. It's over 45 books. I began reading him when I was a teenager, when his books started to come out in the Ace Specials, the Ballantine adult fantasy series. And
Lynn Carter era.
Yes. Lynn Carter was a brilliant editor. And the problem with him is you start to read around and go into used bookstores and pick up more of his works. Some of his stuff is just awful. So you read for a while, and then you lose interest, and you go away. But I always kept coming back. And so I've passed judgment on him. I have run a monograph that tells which of his books are worth reading, which books a genuine masochist could appreciate. And then the rest of them, I assure you, can be ignored with a clean conscience. The Being Gardner d'Oswald, that was I've known Gardner. I met him in 1975. Mm-hmm. I've known him for forever. And he is that rarest of writers, one who can explain his own stories objectively and tell you why he did this rather than that and how it worked and whether it worked. And I often thought, somebody ought to be writing all these things down, but not me. I am no James Boswell. But then at some point, I even forget why, I decided that I could do it as an interview. I think it was I had read Truffaut's interview with Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. And Truffaut simply went through Hitchcock's movies in order that they were made and asked him the technical questions about why he did this and that and the other thing. It's a brilliant interview, and you can learn a lot about filmmaking from it. Mm-hmm. So I started with Garden des Lois. I started with his first published story, The Empty Man,
mm-hmm.
and moved all the way through every story he wrote. I would just, when I went to visit him, I'd take along a tape recorder, and I would just interview him about a story or two. And over the course of several years, whenever I had free time, I'd go and interview him for another couple of stories until I had covered an entire book's worth, which Gardner, at the very end of the interview, when I said, well, I'm done, he said, well, Michael, congratulations. You've done one of those works like building a model of the Titanic out of Q-tips that will stand forever as a monument to gargantuan pointlessness.
Having said that, it got published and published all the wonderful cover, by the way. So.
Yes, it's a... the cover shows Gardner smiling and the top of his head is missing and rockets and things with tentacles are coming out of it, and I'm there peering down brutally into the cavity. It's a wonderful picture by Kai, I forget his name now, Khayyam.
Yeah, I don't.
But no, Omar Khayyam, I think he's actually named. But
really,
yeah. Gardner's grandchildren love that picture, and any time they come to visit his grandson, first thing his grandson says is, "Can I see the picture of Pop Pop with the top of his head off?"
Yeah, he was one of the first guests on this program when Margot Adler was hosting it in 72-73. I think they may have actually been at Clarion together. I think they were in the George Alec Effinger year, as it were. I think they were all in that same group. But I do remember, because I was the engineer in the earliest days of Hour of the Wolf when Margot was doing the show. I remember engineering that. A long time ago, Lord help us, 30-something years ago. Would you care to read more? Would you rather take phone calls or chat?
Well,
more,
if anybody cares to call, I'd be happy to take them.
Okay, telephone number here at WBAI is area code 212-209-2900, and calls are already coming in. For this, you will need headphones. Care to hear the calls. And what I ask of all callers is obviously, you know, be on topic. You know, that's the main thing. We're here to discuss what we are here to discuss. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Robert.
Michael, you are amazing. From Tuesday night to Saturday, and I'm still remembering Chapter 4. short fiction. Have you ever thought of putting together a comparable collection? It obviously sounds like you've got more than a few of your best short fiction pieces.
There is such a thing.
Okay.
Well, no. There was a collection of
in print.
There are two collections in print. There's the Periodic Table of Science Fiction, obviously, which is a British publication from PS Publications. And there was a short slim book called Cigar Box Faust, and other shorts, I think, that was published by Tachyon Publications. Since then, I've written an enormous amount of short shorts. I've lost count of them. I don't think they can be counted anymore. So someday I'd like to see a great big fat book, you know, like a War and Peace of short shorts. But that will be that depends on the publishers.
We really should also mention, by the way, not all short shorts, but having mentioned Tachyon, we should mention recently in print, The Dog Said Bow Wow.
Yes, I should flog that ruthlessly also.
Yes.
I think, Michael, that your short fiction would be appreciated by a certain following of the audience, and that being, and I'm not kidding here, professional storytellers. You have no idea what it is like looking for wonderful, good filler material. That is stories that are 2 minutes, 3 minutes, whatever it is, 5 minutes, and it's not easy to find. And there are a lot of people who look for the kind of story that you did this morning with the Hindenburg. And I would love to see, for example, what you did with elements such as radon, xenon, and argon, and krypton. I believe that's one of the by the way, when you did it, how many elements were there?
118.
118.
Some of which were theoretical.
You mean they don't exist?
They are believed to exist. They have not been found.
Okay.
So when you get up to the upper levels, when you get to the ones where we're not sure whether they exist, they're simply done by number.
Like molybdenum?
Like unhexium, which is 116 in Latin, or unanseptium, or unanoctium. They honestly believe these must surely exist, but they have not found them. They looked everywhere. They looked behind the couch. They looked.
They haven't been found in the field yet.
Or in the field, yes, nowhere.
Well, as I say, short fiction is wonderful. I mean, obviously, you mentioned Frederick Brown. To me, I've always, people have always considered Lord Dunsany a master of that art form. By the way, have you ever done contributions to any of those, what I would call generic compilation anthologies out there that usually go under the title of 365, quote, or 100 Tales of This, or that sort of thing?
No. Nobody's ever asked me.
Oh, they're lost. They're lost. Current Dragons of Babel universe, are you going to be continuing with that down the road? I think that would be wonderful for spin-offs. When I say spin-offs, I mean it would be nice to see already a sort of a background on the kinds of tales that are told within that universe.
I have no idea. The imagination is like a horse, and I've learned how to ride it, but I have not learned how to tell it where to go. So, I may very well. I thought I would never go back to the Iron Dragon's Daughter universe, but in the Iron Dragon's Daughter, the situation was that there was a girl who did not belong in that universe at all, and therefore she could not find a place for it. And in the Dragons of Babel, I realized the reason that it came alive was that I had a young man who did belong in that universe, and thus he could find a place for himself in it. And that became a very different enterprise.
By the way, what was the other short, not compilation you did, but the concept you mentioned, Goya?
Yes, it's called The Sleep of Reason.
What is that, please?
It was a series of 80 etchings that Goya did, and they are dark whimsies. They're about witches, prostitutes, drunkards, and they're really marvelous. Each one of them's got a little paragraph explaining them. So one which you've probably actually seen shows a man who's fallen asleep at his desk, and over him there are hovering cat-headed bats and owls. And the caption for that was, "The Sleep of Reason Produces Monsters." And that was perfect. But all the other etchings have paragraphs explaining them, which are based on Spanish proverbs that nobody understands anymore.
Mm.
And some of them, even I'm certain, have got mixed up because they don't describe the picture at all. And I always thought they all look like they're like right from the middle of a story. And I always wanted to know what that story was. And then one day I realized I could just write these stories for myself.
I mean, this sounds like something that would come out of a Renaissance jest book.
Oh, it's actually a terrific sequence. It's actually my best work in short fiction, but it's darker than the rest.
And all of these are where now? These are all online?
I believe that they're still online at the Infinite Matrix.
Yeah.
.com.
Now that, you see, that would be a wonderful thing if you ever did that in print. Oh.
Well.
I know.
It would be a good coffee table book, but it does exist.
We have plans to do this. I just have to pick up the energy to learn the market and go out and sell it. And my problem is that when I'm feeling energetic, I like to start something new.
I
do hope that it will come out in print. If so,
I hope so.
It would be John Barry doing the production of it, and John Barry is one of the foremost production typeface men in the universe. I once got to tell a guy in a small press that John Barry had looked at his book and said it was not bad. And the guy almost melted with pleasure.
Wow.
By the way, two last things quickly for Jim. I wonder if among your 467 versions of 200, you have anywhere the poor gypsy or gypsies are hanged for what they did. And number two, there are some...
I would have to know the performer, because that's how they're listed.
I'll tell you that sometime. Number two, there are some very good stories that take place totally within the realm of fairy as opposed to borderlands or contact with mortals. One good collection to search is Sylvia Townsend Warner's Kingdoms of Elfin.
Quite wonderful.
Mm.
Great book. Anyway, Michael, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks. Telephone number here at WBAI to speak with Michael Swanwick is 212-209-2900. And good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Yes, hi. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, I'm glad I found the show. I had tuned in and talked to you guys some months ago, and I'd forgotten what day it was, and I got the right day. So what I'd like to ask is if I get off the line, if you would just let me know what time the show starts. I tuned in, I guess, around about 10 minutes ago.
Well, I'm on from 5 to 7 a.m. every Saturday.
Okay.
And at any time of day or night on the web.
Oh, all righty. And the website?
Ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Name of the show is Hour of the Wolf, so it's Our Wolf.
Okay, well, this is delight, because I love books and I love speculative fiction. And since I just tuned in, maybe you were saying whether about having your guests read or go to phone call. So since I'm sort of late, if you could maybe, I understand he writes short fiction.
Yes, I do.
Oh, that's very interesting. I'd like to, as I hang up, I'd like to get his full name, and if he might go to one of the stories, I would be delighted to actually hear. I guess he read some of his work earlier.
He read one story earlier, and as we are speaking, he is thumbing through the elements.
And which one was that I missed?
That was Hydrogen.
Hydrogen, what a great name. And is there a book that's available?
There is, from PS Publishing, which is a British publisher, and it is Michael Swan. No, that's the different title. The Science Fiction Periodic Guide.
No, the Periodic Table of Science Fiction.
That's it.
Okay, Periodic Table of Science Fiction,
mm-hmm,
by PS Publishing. And Michael's last name is?
Swanwick, Swanwick.
Swanwick. And the host is?
I am Jim Freund.
Jim, it's so delightful to hear your voice, and I'm going to be a regular listener when I'm up at this time, and I'll be looking forward to his reading of the next short science fiction piece.
Okay, great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Is that now, or you want to take another call?
Take another call so I can leaf through here and find a good one.
Good morning. You're on the radio. Whoops, no, you're a dial tone, so you're not on the air. Hi, you're on the air. Ah, this is our phone system. It's not the caller. It's just a bizarre, non-working phone system. Hi, you're on the radio.
Hi, Jim. It's Lisa. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
I'm all right. It was interesting. Philip Pullman was on Charlie Rose tonight.
Oh, was he really? I'm sorry I missed that.
And he was talking about his writing regimen, which was slightly different, and he said something surprising. He writes every day, and his quota is not in terms of number of hours writing, but he says he's committed to writing 1,000 words per day. And it's not a minimum for him. He writes, if he gets 1,000 words out, he's done.
I think it's the Samuel Johnson method also. I think that he used to specify a word count.
And what he also said in regard to that, it was the same thing that I think most serious writers say, is if you wait for inspiration, you're not going to be writing very much. And he said not only does he write without waiting for inspiration, but that, in fact, having this 1,000 words as a maximum and stopping, if you really have the juices flowing and you're enthusiastic and your muse has hit you, it's very good to stop at 1,000 words because it's then ever so easy to pick up the next time. And I thought that was astonishing. I had never heard a writer say that when he actually had everything going, that was the time for him to just stop and not write as much as he could while he was while everything was flowing. I wanted to hear Michael Swanwick's response to that.
I am more of a pessimist than he is. If I'm
not saying something, but more of a pessimist than Phil Pullman is. Going far. That's deep into the Russian literature side.
If I have something good, I'm afraid of losing it. So I still send my wife flowers. You know, I do not take anything for granted. So no,
flowers at that.
If I'm on a roll, I will just keep writing. I had a great experience once. I was going to a friend's reading, and very shortly after the reading began, I discovered two things. One of which was I had already heard this particular work because I'd seen it in manuscript, and I'd been asked for advice. And the other was that my friend was one of the worst readers I'd ever heard in my life. And for a while there, it was. It was possible to get some interest in seeing if there would be a grammatical error in every single sentence. But after that, it became clear that, yes, there would be. That I took on my notebook out and I started just word doodling. And I wrote down, hello, said the stick, just at random. I said, oh, that looks interesting. And so I started writing on the next paragraph. And I started, imagining the story. And by the time the reading was over, I had the story plotted out. And the next day was Saturday. I woke, and I got up Saturday. I said to Marianne, I said, I'm going to go upstairs and write for a while. And she said, oh, okay. And I went upstairs, and I wrote a short story called Hello, Said the Stick. And I got it mailed into the mail by 3 o'clock when the post office closed that afternoon. So that was something like 18 hours from start to finish, and I got to sleep late in between. So what a great experience that was. if only it were always like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard composers talk about that in interviews. Sooner or later, one of them will say that there was a song that just wrote itself, you know, or I woke up and I had the song in my dream, or I heard something and, you know, an hour later it took as long to just, I basically just wrote it down. I didn't write it, it just came to me. And what you're saying parallels my experience that I found at the late lamented Bottom Line, when I would go and listen to music and I would see a lot of the singer-songwriters who had very quirky lyrics, and either the song was a story or it evoked characters, and I would find myself jotting down lyrics and story ideas, and just being in the presence of hearing all of that did loosen things up. And it sounds like listening to a story had the same effect on you as hearing a song does for a lot of people.
It's all absolutely true, although I have to add that that in order to be able to do that when it comes, in order to let a song or a story just come when it does, you have to have been working really hard all the time so that you're prepared for it. C.S. Lewis once said that that sometimes you have to build an altar in one place so that fire can fall from the sky somewhere else.
Mm.
And that's the phenomenon. There are a lot of Ghanabi writers and other artists who just sit around waiting for inspiration. And the problem is that if you're not working when you're waiting for inspiration, when it comes, you may not know what to do with it.
It's like exercise and toning up the muscles.
Exactly right.
Also, have you ever...
I should just point out, if we're going to get another short story in, we have 5 minutes of airtime left.
Okay, then I will call this to a close and hope to chat with you in person again sometime. Take care, both of you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. So, you've chosen an element for us.
Yes, element 88, radium, atomic weight 226, and the story is called The Ghost of Pierre Curie Reminisces. She had a radiant smile. It lit up the night. Her name was Marie Sklodowska when I met her. I was working on crystallography, piezoelectricity, and the effects of temperature on magnetism at the time, but the real magnetism was all hers. We went dancing. So taken with her was I that I stuttered and stammered and spoke like a fool. It made me flush red with anger at myself. But then she touched my shoulder with her gloved hand, and I looked into those amazing eyes of hers and was trapped as firmly as a single chromium atom in a ruby lattice. We wed. To the world, she became Madame Curie, but to me, she was ever and always Marie. At the École de Physique et de Chimie Industrielle, she measured the strength of uranium compounds and made the surprising discovery that pitchblende emitted 4 times more radiation than could be explained by its uranium content. Seeing the implications immediately, I joined her in her research. Together we discovered polonium and radium. We isolated a gram of radium salts and determined the atomic weights and properties of both elements. In 1903, we shared the Nobel Prize in Physics. Oh, the passion we shared that night in our enormous bed on the top floor of the Grand Hotel in Stockholm. I would not have traded that evening for 1,000 Nobel Prizes. She fell asleep in my arms, but I stayed up for hours marveling at the richness of our life together. 2 years later, I was killed in a wagon accident. Marie grieved and soldiered on. She became the first female lecturer at the Sorbonne. In 1911, she received a second Nobel, this time for chemistry. She put all her energies into the development of the uses of X-rays in medicine. Now she is old and dying, and I, a spirit no more tangible than the cosmic radiation that sleets unhindered through human flesh, hover at her bedside and whisper endearments that she cannot hear. Oh, Marie, do you remember my arms about you? Do you remember my hands, my mouth? Do you remember our research, our long and patient hours at the electrometer? Do you remember that night when you touched my shoulder with your white-gloved hand and we danced? Around and around we whirled like the twin electrons in helium's solitary and self-sufficient shell.
Radium by Michael Swanwick. Here on WBAI New York, part of the Periodic Table of Science Fiction, as originally published at sci-fi.com, edited by Ellen Datlow, and now from PS Publishing. And I think that the sci-fi.com is still available as a ghost site. It's not updated, but it can be accessed.
Yes, although I believe not for long.
Not for long, although... it can be archived, so people should rush to it now and collect those elements you want. Michael Swanwick's website is available at, is it michaelswanwick.com?
Well, it is michaelswanwick.com, and the blog is floggingbabel.blogspot.com.
Okay, and going to michaelswanwick.com, it's easy to get to the blog.
I believe it is, although I've been lazy and I haven't updated the website for a couple of months. So
yeah, I've noticed.
I'm in trouble here.
I've noticed that, but there's a link to the blog right on front. And the latest book is The Dragons of Babel, which can be read as a standalone.
Absolutely. It's an absolute standalone. It's a great book. Everybody needs to buy it. I need to express myself more confidently.
Yes, yeah. You shouldn't be so modest and laid back on this one. But since everything else you've written is so brilliant and fabulous, why would this be any different?
It's actually better.
Since I look forward to reading everything that I've written in the past, there's a time conundrum, then I know this will be no different. So it has been so many years getting you here live on the air, and I'm so pleased that we were able to do it. And hopefully we could do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Next 25 years is coming up
before you
2032, blink. I'll be there.
There you go. Okay. So thank you, Michael Swanwick. Thank you, Marianne, for loaning us Michael for this morning. Thank you, listeners, for being here. We will be back next week with John Joseph Adams. Stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Locally. And in the meantime, everybody, enjoy yourselves and have a great week. Take care and good morning.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we look at U.S.-backed police state developments in Mexico and the increasing loss of human rights and attacks on journalists there. We'll speak with Laura Carlson in Mexico City. She's the director of the Center for International Policy, America's Project. Next, we'll have updates on Fukushima radiation and its impacts on the ocean and animal life, both in Japan and the west coast of the U.S. Marine radiochemist Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and research biologist and professor Timothy Musu of the University of South Carolina Columbia share their recent research on the matter. To conclude the program, we'll hear a rebroadcast of a recent interview with Professor Carl Gross.